It's December 5th, 2011. This is the Hell Yeah Show. Hello and welcome to the Hell Yeah Show. I'm Alan.
I'm Emery.
And we are bringing you best practices for fine living, advice on how to not let technology ruin your day. Emery.
Back from whence you came.
I do not know what this is referring to.
It's what Job yells when he's throwing the dead dove into the ocean.
Oh, is it really? That's fantastic. All right.
And since we're talking about email later, one of the other parts of that same episode is where he's trying to, well, he throws the insurance check into the ocean.
Yes.
As in an act of defiance.
Uh-huh. Is this your metaphor for email?
Yeah, pretty much. Back okay. from whence you came.
All right, we are going to talk about email later in the show. We got some other topics to cover before we get there, but we got a lot to say about email. Emery is historically big on the email nitty-gritty, big on the figuring out your email pipeline.
I'm big on all sorts of minutia.
Exactly. So we'll discuss that at length later in the show. But yeah. Before we get to that, a couple news items here. This is something happening tomorrow if you own an Xbox 360. The new Xbox dashboard is coming out.
Yeah.
And this has been due out for a while. It's got some neat stuff in it. There's new voice search and a lot of voice command stuff. Native Kinect integration. So when you use your Kinect, you're no longer in this other interface. You can just use the Kinect in the basic interface. Lots of TV and video content, including some live TV stuff.
That's awesome.
Yes. Yeah, it's great. And a whole new kind of refined, cleaned up, reorganized interface that's actually really, really fast. They definitely put a lot of effort into taking the tasks that people do often and making them much faster in this interface than in the previous iteration.
Well, that'll be exciting then.
Yeah, it'll be good. So, I think one of the big things here that we might want to touch on is this TV and video content thing. That this thing that was originally just a gaming system for the most part is now becoming actually if you subscribe to I think it's Verizon Fios or Comcast that you can actually get all of your TV on this device, which is pretty crazy.
That's badass.
It's kind of a shift from the. It's a big shift from the traditional cable model, and it's interesting that despite that, it's the cable companies that are still that are still driving this, right? The content's still coming through the cable companies.
Sure. Well, I mean, anyone that can distribute that much content, I mean, they don't really. I mean, part of me wants to believe that they don't really care how it gets there, but they want to be the person that brokers it.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Because they see Netflix and Amazon and Hulu. There's other people that are and Apple that are kind of setting themselves up to handle that part of their business, and I think that it's definitely in their best interest to find a way to maintain some level of control there.
Yeah,
I heard a report that like this is supposed to be the year where the number of TVs sold actually starts to decline.
Whoa!
That we've already this is the year of the crest.
Wait, I mean, you still need a TV to run all this stuff? I mean, you still need, at the end of the day, you still need a screen to put it on.
Yeah, but I think people are using monitors and projectors and I don't know. Apparently people aren't buying TVs anymore, and some people are just happy with their computer.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, there are households that have an iMac, and then they have a 24-inch iMac in their living room. I've seen that. Anecdotally, I don't know what the actual numbers are on it, but I mean, there's people that have a home theater PC with a display of some sort that's not a television.
Well, and even the move to portable devices or to personal devices, the idea that
that's true.
You're watching your content on your iPad while everyone else in the family is watching their content on their iPads because you're all watching different shows rather than gathering around one big TV.
One of my younger cousins, I mean, when we were at the Thanksgiving thing, I mean, she's watching Hulu in her bedroom. She doesn't have a TV.
Right, yeah.
But there's a computer or a laptop in the kids' rooms, and they're watching stuff online. They don't watch TV the way that I watch TV anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And, you know, so it, there is the cable company stuff is a big part of this new Xbox dashboard. But also, of course, there's all the online stuff that we've been talking about, the Hulu, the Netflix. You dug up this fact that apparently half of all Netflix traffic in primetime is driven by Xboxes.
Yeah. So, and I just heard this coming back from dinner tonight. I was listening to the radio in the car, and there was a conversation on public radio, and someone was saying that half of all the internet traffic during the prime TV watching window, so I guess, you know, from like what would that be, like 7 p.m. to 11 p.m.?
Sure.
Is half of that is streaming traffic, and that half of the traffic that Netflix is getting in prime time is through Xbox 360 users.
Huh. Yeah, and I had actually today, earlier today as well, heard the statistic that overall about 20% of all IP traffic online is due to Netflix.
I can corroborate that.
Yeah, and compare that to I think BitTorrent is about 8 or 9, something like that.
A little bit, yeah. In my environment specifically, we see about 20%, especially on like wireless devices.
Uh-huh.
We see a lot of like our student population. It's mainly iTunes and Netflix, and yeah.
Wow. Yeah,
and it's remarkable.
That is a big shift from BitTorrent.
You know, less
previously
than five,
dominating everything.
Less than 5 years ago,
yeah.
It was definitely peer to peer file sharing was in the place of Netflix.
Right, and but, I think, you know, one of the big things driving this is this sort of thing with Xbox and with iPad and whatever is, you know, on these devices you don't have BitTorrent. You've got these other services, and
well, no, and the whole argument has always been that the reason there were so many people using peer-to-peer file sharing services was because there was no other way for them to get the content. Like, there
right.
was no legitimate path.
Yeah, right.
So
right.
the consumers were going to go do something else. And
I think so many people dismissed that as idealistic, but in actuality, no, that turned out to be the case.
Yeah, they were full of crap. Like, they didn't know, and they were just happy to pin it out there as saying, you know, oh, this is all people illegitimate, blah, blah, blah. But, like, I don't think that they really thought it through. I mean, if there is a way that is elegant and lets me control the media in terms of, like, you know, if I watch something on Netflix, I don't have to, like, click through ads, and I don't have to, like, install a plugin
right.
to view it. You know what
yep.
I mean? Like, I can play it on my PlayStation or my Apple TV, and it just works.
Yep.
If I rent a movie on iTunes, if I buy an episode of a TV show, like, it's easy and it's inexpensive. And those are really the two things that are going to be your biggest barrier.
Sure. Yeah.
I mean, I have no interest in, like, what? I don't know why I would do it any other way. I mean, it's just too convenient.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. Anyway, but this new Xbox stuff looks interesting, both for this extra content reason. Also, it's a really nice interface from what I've seen of it. It's really, really easy to get around, both by voice searching, by Kinect waving, or by controller pressing. So
the use case in particular they were talking about on the radio was you could say, like, you know, do a Bing search for a movie, and Bing would return, you know, if it's, you know, in theaters, it would return movie listings, and if it's online, it would return, like, you know, Netflix results or,
sure.
you know,
sure.
iTunes
kind
results
of like Google yeah. TV was supposed to be.
Did that ever? I never even. I used it once at Best Buy, and it was just not. I mean, I didn't get it.
I think they've improved on it over time, but I don't know that it's. I certainly haven't seen it around. You know, it hasn't become a.
I mean, it's in retail stores. I mean, they have it.
Right. Yeah, I mean, but it hasn't become widely adopted in a way. Like Xbox. I mean, there are. I can pretty surely say there are nowhere near as many Google TVs out there as there are Xboxes.
Absolutely not.
Right.
Yeah.
So this is kind of pushing Xbox in that direction a bit. And also, I think it's really interesting that they're able to combine three very different interaction mechanisms, the voice, the Kinect, and the controller, into one interface that actually does work well. I think that's pretty impressive. So.
It's very impressive. I mean, nobody else really does that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, okay. On the less impressive side of technology, we have continued updates. Maybe it's impressive about Carrier IQ, which is now potentially violating federal wiretap laws.
Who knows? I mean, this is going to be a pretty epic tale, I think, by the time it's all done.
Yeah. So we've got a whole lot of stories that came out in the past week. We talked about this on last show, of course, but couple updates here. Al Franken sent out a letter that you should probably read. It's pretty great. That basically says, or lists this page after page of questions for Carrier IQ, asking Carrier IQ to answer all of these questions. Yeah. And just, I mean, if nothing else, this shows that, you know, someone at a high level has taken notice of this.
Yeah, but no one really takes Al Franken seriously.
I think he's a senator now.
Well, bravo. I mean, so is that wingnut from Arizona. From what I know of his political career, I'd say it's pretty good. I mean, he's definitely a no-nonsense guy, and he gets people's attention, and he's really working on behalf of his constituents, and I like that. But I don't know that he has the same cachet that someone else might have.
I think that the reason he... the reason he was the one that wrote this letter, I guess maybe he cares personally about it, but he's also the chair of... Oh, what was the committee? I'll have it in a second here.
He's one of the guys that also, like, I think was holding up on Sony and a couple of other... And Apple, too. Like,
he's the chairman of the Subcommittee on Privacy, Technology, and the Law.
Good.
So, yeah, there you go.
I'm glad to see there's, like, a real pitbull there that's, like, writing good letters.
Yeah.
I just don't know.
It's really good to see.
Yeah.
We'll see where it goes. And also, we've got more more stuff from a variety of researchers that I guess have looked into this further.
In the show notes, I mean, there's two in particular that are worth looking at. And one of them, the second one from Vulnerability Factory. Basically, there's some open questions on what Carrier IQ even does. And there's this interesting thing going on right now where Carrier IQ is really trying to kind of like reframe the issue. And the way that they're framing things right now and the way that they phrase their answers to these questions, it's really clear that the operators themselves are the ones that are actually doing this. Huh. Like Carrier IQ has the technology, they have the technology and they have, you know, the service and the software. But the carriers and the operators are the ones that actually dictate how this gets used.
Right.
And remember a few weeks ago, we were talking about how mobile operators retain text messages and records of phone calls
for varying amounts of time. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know what? I was wondering, like, is it possible that they are leveraging Carrier IQ's software and their technology to do that?
It's possible. Yeah.
The examples that were given where, you know, it was logging keystrokes and things like that, like they've kind of like tried to brush this off as that was like a debug issue. And then the assertion that they're making and what these other independent researchers are making is that by default, like the Carrier IQ software doesn't do that. But if you give an application debug access or something like that, then it can do that. And this is, I guess, specifically on the Android side, this is something that there's been a problem with. And I guess, what was it? We saw an article, we didn't talk about it, but I think there was like a 420% increase in Android malware last quarter.
Well, that was entirely Carrier IQ, actually.
Yeah. That was one for every Android handset sold. But there's a... I think it was something like... I don't know, like there's... The permissions control on mobile applications can be a little dicey. And it's like when you go to like install a browser plugin and it's like, hey, just so you know, this plugin needs access to your entire browsing history and all of your email. Mm-hmm. You know, like,
yeah.
And you're like, okay, like 10,000 people can't be wrong. I don't know. Like maybe it's something like that. But
I think for tracking text messages specifically, I mean, like that's the kind of thing where, you know, your text message isn't end-to-end encrypted between you and the person you send it to.
No.
So the carrier, it's pretty fair to assume that the carrier can intercept your text messages fairly easily if they want to.
They can see that anyways, yeah.
Yeah.
But, I mean, there is like this law enforcement angle. Like some of this might be how they satisfy their requirements for CALEA. And that's the law enforcement, like lawful intercept stuff in the United States, where like you, if you're a telecom service provider or mobile operator, you have to have a way to provide law enforcement with very verbose and copious amounts of data on any subscriber. And I think that it's possible that in some cases they're relying on this software to do it because, I mean, if I'm being objective about it, like if the carrier is already implementing the software on the devices that they sell so that they can get some sort of like metrics anyways, then they may also decide to kill two birds with one stone, so to speak, and also do this.
Right.
And who knows? I mean, like, there are a lot of people now that are kind of going back through their historical data to see like how many connections and how often and how much data is being transferred to the carrier IQ. Like NetBlocks got released. There's a paste bin, the note that has like their entire they have a whole /24 class C of servers and what they are and what they're for and which one. Yeah, so there's, I mean, you can find out what IP addresses to look for on your home network if you're curious, if you've got a device that's phoning in. But I mean, like carrier IQ statements that are like, you know, we sell the software and we let people implement it and we support it, but it's up to the operators to decide what they do with it. I mean, they're clearly trying to put the pressure back on the mobile operators, which I think is entirely possible where it should be.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, I don't know that I'll have to read Andy Greenberg's article on Forbes about how there's some concerns that they may have broken or violated federal wiretapping law. But I mean, first of all, the federal government disregards wiretap laws all the time anyway. Like, I don't know that they're going to, you know, be
it's different for a private company.
Yeah, well, yeah. Is it? Because, I mean, the federal government compels private companies to do it for them.
Like, oh, right. Oh, no, I see what you're saying. Yeah. Well, I mean, you were talking earlier about how that it's a requirement for them to keep a lot of these records anyway. Yeah.
Yeah. And they also had, like, isn't it Facebook? And well, a lot of people have, like, these law enforcement agency portals where you can just kind of request information and click a little box that says that you have, you know, reasonable interest in this and that it's related to an ongoing investigation, and they don't really do a whole lot to clarify that in some cases.
Yeah,
but I if it ends up being a carrier issue, I say feed her to the wolves. I mean, screw them anyways.
So I'm serious. And then we were talking about this earlier, and I was saying I thought this was going to end carrier IQ.
Yeah, I don't know that it will.
I think that this will, however,
have an interesting impact on the operators themselves and put some more pressure on them to kind of disclose what they're keeping on people, because they really skate on this. And I think a lot of I think the consumers in the United States are just getting fleeced by these guys.
Right. Yeah. And we've talked repeatedly about how there are beginning to be alternatives to the traditional mobile carrier.
Yeah. And then people like Ting.
Right. Yeah. And that there may be soon enough, there may be a reality where you can switch without too much trouble. You can switch from your mobile carrier to an alternative solution. And when that arises, then the carriers are definitely going to be a lot more on the hook for this sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, I don't know that they will. I mean, I think that if nothing else, as a culture in the United States, we have demonstrated that we really just don't give a crap, and that, you know, a $5 discount on a $200 a month service is enough to make us shut up just about anything. Like, oh, wow, a whole $5. Well, yeah. I mean, like, the whole point of things like, you know, Facebook or other services is to intentionally get you to disclose personal and private things to a corporate entity. And we do that for free. And in fact, like, they make billions of dollars off of us, and we really don't get much out of the relationship except for a fake farm.
Well, I mean, to be fair, that's a fake farm that your friends can see.
That's true. They can visit. They can visit the fake farm.
Yeah.
So I don't know that the American consumer is really chomping at the bit to go after anybody.
But I mean, like, you and I are American consumers, you know. I mean, that there are people out, clearly from the amount of news Carrier IQ has generated, the amount of buzz it's generated, clearly there are people, there's a significant number of people out there that care about this sort of thing.
That's true. I mean, there's people paying attention and they pick up the call, you know, they make the phone calls and they send letters occasionally. But I mean, in general, I think there's too much apathy for them to really be in a lot of danger. Hmm. I mean, like, even in the case of like the AT&T and T-Mobile thing, like, I had a trouble ticket with AT&T open where I was complaining about something, and probably the fact that, you know, I was getting less than a quarter megabit on my 3G data service again. And the email I got back from AT&T support included this several paragraph excuse where they're asking me to contact my congressman to like put pressure on the FCC to let them acquire T-Mobile because that'll solve my problem. I am not kidding. Like I read through this and I sent it back and I was like, are you kidding me with this? Like, yeah, it was, yeah.
Huh.
It's, yeah.
All right. Well, speaking of, about apathy, there's, that I think we've talked about this on the show before, but there's this eminent transition between the current standard for internet addressing, IPv4, and what is supposed to be the next generation future standard for internet addressing, IPv6.
Yeah.
And I put that lowercase I, didn't I?
Yeah.
It's a capital IPv6.
Yeah, there's... Yeah, so most people are familiar with the internet today using what's called IPv4, and that is a dotted quad IP address. So your home network that might be, you know, 192.168.0.1/24 mm-hmm. is 255 usable IP addresses on a private, non-routable space. Now, there are all of these networks across the internet, and globally, they're exhausted in terms of they've all been allocated. They're not all used. There's a lot of private companies that have large IP allocations that are completely empty. There's plenty of IP addresses that are actually not being used, but they've all been allocated.
But even with those, even with those inefficiencies, there still aren't going to be enough addresses to go around.
Oh, no.
Right.
So there's, and that's a real problem. Like, because various service providers and telcos and companies can't get large allocations anymore, there's kind of a shortage there. And that's kind of hastened the deployment of this next generation IP protocol called IPv6. And there's a lot of things about IPv6 that are really great. And it solves a lot of problems that modern IPv4 networks have.
So IPv6 is 128 bits, which means there are 2 to the 128th or 340 undecillion addresses.
Yeah, that's a lot.
In fact, I learned today the minimum allocation, like if someone requests a block of IPv6 addresses for their network, the minimum allocation is several quadrillion addresses.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like you cannot, if you're going to have a network, you cannot own less than that number of addresses.
There's, I think like the current, well, from what I understand, I can't remember now. There's, if I go like super nerdy on it, there's, when I say like, you know, /24/16, that's called a CIDR or classless delegation or, CIDR notation, which is a way of referring to how many usable addresses are in a net block. And, I don't know what the default is for operators, but I know that like internet providers that are looking at like residential service, there's kind of this back and forth on if they're going to be giving people /48s or /64s, which are still, you know, that's a very large. That's essentially because the assumption is that more and more of your devices will eventually want to have address space that's reachable.
Right.
Globally.
Yeah. Well, I also learned today that, apparently, the Department of Defense acquired like several million of these undecillion blocks. These quadrillion blocks.
and since they're in hexadecimal, you can get kind of funky with them. So Facebook's IPv6 net block contains the name FACE
B00C.
No. I mean, it's FACE and part of their allocation.
No,
it's
no, like, I know.
Oh, yeah. But then they Google, I think, has one too that's kind of undemonic of some sort.
Cisco has, I think Cisco dog food is...
that's a classic.
Is one of theirs,
nerd.
Yeah. And Freenode has I think it's like Dead Beef Club.
Dead Beef is it's a classic. That's like the people with Spark stations. You could set your MAC address, and people routinely would do things like decaf bad, Dead Beef.
Yeah. So anyway, but this IPv6 stuff opens up this absolutely massive address space, which would basically allow for so many independent devices that everything out there could have its own address.
There is an IPv6 only internet. There are devices that don't have V4 connectivity.
You can create your own network that uses IPv6. It's a standard that's actually implemented on almost all the hardware out there. Your mobile phone supports it. Your routers support it.
Yes,
usually.
No. There's a lot of consumer stuff that does not support it at all. And
really?
I don't know that game consoles and some media players don't have a clue.
Huh.
But I know that the Apple Airport Extreme does. And if you're a provider, like in my case, I have DSL service through Quest, and they don't offer IPv6. But I allocate myself a tunnel from Hurricane Electric. And my Airport Extreme essentially picks up and tunnels and routes my house a V6 allocated net block from Hurricane Electric for all the machines in the house. So when I'm at home, I have V6 connectivity. It's not native, it's tunneled, but I have routable address space in my house.
But even though you are doing that, and you are a very good citizen of the internet for doing that.
Yeah, I'd be better citizen of the internet if I had native V6 connectivity.
Right. But you're pretty good. You're as good as you can be with your current internet service provider.
Yeah.
But when you initiate a connection to Google or to Yahoo or whatever, they are not using IPv6.
Yes, they are.
No, not currently.
Google does.
So Google does if you are on, and you probably are, but Google does if you are within a network that they have sort of pre-whitelisted for IPv6.
If you just go to ipv6.google.com, if you have V6 connectivity, you will use it no matter what.
So if you force it, yes.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that they have... I don't know what their whitelisting thing is. I mean, you're saying this because of the gentleman that presented at your campus.
I'm basing this on some stuff I overheard earlier today. Went to a talk earlier today that basically the end result of the talk was currently IPv6 is more difficult than we'd like it to be by a pretty significant margin. It's going to prove more difficult to transition to than we'd like it to be. And the sort of main rationale behind this is that there is no good monetary incentive for, say, a Time Warner or a Comcast to switch their entire network over to IPv6, or even to switch large portions of their network over to IPv6.
I can confirm that Google will not return a Quad A record from my house.
Right.
The only way that I will get dumped onto the V6 Google is if I tell it that I want V6.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
So it doesn't even try.
Yeah. I mean, that's because there are a lot of issues currently. The way the internet is architected was obviously not originally conducive to IPv6. So it's kind
malarkey.
That's
nonsense. I disagree.
What? Okay.
I disagree with that. I think the main barrier to adoption on V6 is that because there was so much of this issue leading up to this point, people have invested very heavily in building their networks to be NATed and to have various egress and ingress points.
No, actually, you are completely right. I am wrong on that. Yeah, right. I mean, the internet was originally intended to be every device has its own address. They all communicate.
It's an open campus. Yeah, everyone.
End to end. Right.
Yep. And so as things got built out to be kind of segregated and walled off, I think that is one of the bigger barriers to wide adoption of V6. And right, it's also right. what disincentivizes it. I mean, I understand the argument that V4 is a artificially scarce. Well, it's not artificially scarce, but they kind of perpetuate the scarcity and that gives them this financial incentive to keep things on V4. But I think that there's a lot of really very important costs for the operators and the providers, for especially on the residential side, that is also very much at play. And, yeah. and I think that's really up to the services themselves to deploy service on V6 before those providers are really being spurred into action.
Right.
Like, your ISP is not going to give you native V6 right now when the only things you can do with it are Google searches, Netflix, and chat on Freenode. Like, they, you know, they don't care.
And BitTorrent.
Yeah, and BitTorrent.
Yeah, they love that.
Is, yeah, there is a lot of, I mean, like, Netflix is native V6, or it was, at least. I haven't checked.
That.
But,
huh.
but yeah, there was, well, I should quantify that, because I know that the Amazon data centers don't seem to support native V6, and a lot of the Netflix stuff is on that now. So I think it really depends on where you're going.
And on the opposite side of things, if you look at something like Skype, Skype's, the technology behind Skype is architected very specifically to deal with the current structure of the internet as it is architected to work for IPv4.
Yep.
So a transition to IPv6 is not something that Skype would really want to get full on board with, because it would basically result in them having to re-architect their entire system.
Well, I think it would... I don't know they would have them architect their entire system, but it would definitely require them to make some changes to how their protocol works. I mean, their Skype is designed to work on heavily NATed firewalled networks by using this peer-to-peer technology that they have.
Mm-hmm.
And on a flat V6 internet, on a hypothetical flat V6 internet, that a lot of that wouldn't be necessary. So there's also a possibility that, you know, Skype for IPv6 would have higher quality and a better service.
Sure.
But
yeah.
It
but
also
it's the in between time that I think is a bit scary.
Yeah, but really, it's on them how they implement their protocol. I mean, like, if they don't use the OS as kind of like this arbiter for IP connectivity, then that's kind of bad on them. I mean, there's a lot of software that just works on V6 because it doesn't care.
Right. Yeah, I mean, but then, you know, so here's the point that I'm trying to bring up here is basically, if there's no incentive for someone like Skype to do this, or even necessarily someone like Yahoo, Facebook, or Google, because at the moment, them switching over to IPv6 has the potential to break their services for a lot of their customers. So if there's not much incentive on that end, and there's not much incentive on the provider end because the services aren't using it, like, where is the incentive going to come from?
Well, that's just it. I mean, the incentive has to come from services that are actually deployed on it. And in the meantime, people are doing these dual stack deployments. I mean, no one's doing V6 only.
Right.
And, you know, I don't know. I mean, do you think that people are going to, like, intentionally hamper the adoption of V6 for that reason?
Well, I think, you know, I think someone like Skype is in a position to do that, because for them, it's significant cost and uncertainty.
It's far less cost for them to implement V6 than it is for Comcast.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And well, I think someone like Comcast would hamper it as well. You know, I think, you know, an internet
Comcast
service provider
has just started rolling it out. They've just started deploying V6 to some
to San Francisco. Yeah.
Well, not just San Francisco. I think they have a couple of, like, I mean, admittedly limited markets. But I mean, also keep in mind, though, there is a really big support issue, and that is that not all the equipment that consumers have supports V6 to begin with.
Yeah.
And there's going to be a cost in replacing that equipment for the customer premise stuff that they provide and for the consumers who have to go out and buy new stuff. And then there's also the added issue of support, where instead of, I mean, I don't think that anyone, there's, you know, fewer than five people in my family that can tell you what an IP address even is. but they would probably know it if they saw it, but they wouldn't know a V6 address if they saw it.
Sure.
Like, that would scare the hell out of them.
Yeah. And like, and if anything goes wrong, it's my internet is broken, it's your fault.
And there's like, you know, the tech support staff now is going to have to know a little bit more about IP networking than they do right now. I mean, and, you know, getting someone to type in ping and then like an IP address that's 16 characters long instead of, you know, seven.
Right.
I don't
know.
Like, it sounds stupid, but I think that a big barrier to this is primarily support and human.
Sure.
I don't know. I don't have the global view that your presenter has, but I'm just saying from our perspective, from my perspective, I think that if people are using V6, the operators and the service providers are going to have to get on board. But until people are using it, then they just don't care. And I mean, there's also a lot of people that are using it unintentionally, because in like Windows 7 and Vista, Teredo, there's like these transitional V4 to V6 tunneling protocols that just happen. Huh. So if you don't explicitly disable it, there's people that are using V6 over V4 via tunneling, and you end up like getting routed to these 6-to-4 gateways elsewhere on the internet, and your traffic is going who knows where,
right,
on its way to where you're supposed to be going. So there is an incentive on the service providers to at least better support V6. Otherwise, you know, your service might suck, because when you go to a data center in Texas, you might be going there by way of Maine.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, so
there are issues.
Yeah. And that's fairly like, I wonder if we could get someone like, I know someone that would probably be good to talk about this.
Yeah. Well, it is only going to become a more important issue. So I think
he's in France. What time is it?
Oh, Let's call him up, you know.
He's not French, but he is he was the senior engineer of AboveNet in Europe for a long time. And I think now he's just doing like private consulting stuff. But I bet he does some V6.
All right.
And there's also people like, you know, that I work with that know a hell of a lot more about than I ever would. But
sure. So for the time being though, I'd say be concerned and keep an eye on it.
Be afraid.
Be very afraid. And you know, hopefully we can avoid a future of scarce enough IPv4 addresses where it's this big global bidding war for the addresses.
It's already over.
What?
There are no more.
Oh, no. They've all the IPv4 addresses have been allocated. But,
yeah.
I mean, just recently, Microsoft bought, I think, like, some, you know, several hundred thousand addresses from Nortel. You know, so there are people out there that still have addresses that they may not need all of, and I think we're going to see a lot of those addresses be sold back and forth.
and that's kind of shady. Actually, that's very shady.
It is.
You know, the allocations originally, I don't think even cost anybody anything.
Yep.
So like, there are people out there that have like, you know, a class B, and they're not using anywhere near that, and yet they're sitting on it, and I don't know. That's when I was saying artificial scarcity. That's what I'm talking about. Because it's like, you know, it's something that didn't cost them anything. It doesn't take up any room for them. Like, it's not like something that they have to like inventory and store somewhere.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just
same thing happened with educational radio bandwidth. A lot of universities and you know, educational institutions got allocated by the FCC, you know, FM bandwidth for educational radio. And recently, we've seen actually a decent number of those educational institutions selling off that spectrum to...
Really?
Yes, to oftentimes nonprofit broadcasters, but not necessarily educational nonprofit broadcasters.
It shouldn't be sold. Period. If you didn't pay something to get something, and you have it allocated to you, then you should not be allowed to profit from it in any way.
Well, I think there are exceptions to that, but for this type of, it was allocated to you as part of a, you know, this is to be used for this purpose type of thing. You should certainly not be able to resell it for a different purpose.
Yeah, that's weird.
Yeah. Anyway, but so the whole IPv4, IPv6 situation is certainly going to be interesting to watch.
Yeah,
we'll keep an eye on it and maybe have more in future episodes.
Yeah, we could put. Well, I don't know. Hold on a second. Do I have it? I'm trying to think if I have. Tell you what, you can currently reach the Hell Yeah Show via IPv6.
No way.
Yep.
Oh man, this is great.
Yeah, if you have native V6 connectivity, you will be able to reach our website on IPv6.
Fantastic. All right, we're ahead of the curve. We're good. We're transitioned.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We problem solved.
Problem solved. We have solved IPv6. All right. Okay. Moving on here. The topic that promised at the head of the show we would address this episode is a pretty heavy topic, something a lot of people, everyone that's listening, I'm sure, deals with quite a bit, and that is email. It's it's as I said, it's something everyone deals with, and it's something that a lot of people hate for various reasons.
Yeah.
So we wanted to kind of go through what our email practices are and maybe give some larger insights about email management and various things that can help you improve your email workflow, that sort of stuff. So, yep. Emery, you want to start us off here?
Well, lately I've been using a mail client for macOS 10 that I really like called MailMate, and it's from Freeron. It's actually like, you know, a development shop of one. It's a dude named Benny who lives in Belgium. And I love it. I think it's probably, you know, my favorite email client that I've used, second only to Mutt.
All right, tell us about MailMate and then tell us about Mutt.
Well, okay, so some of the things I really like about MailMate are that I can assign a key binding for any action in the client. So if you're really comfortable with the Gmail hotkeys for, you know, traversing mail folders and sending messages and things like that, it does that beautifully. You can also just rebind whatever you want through a simple plist file that you can edit in your text editor and then just save it out and you're good to go. It also supports Markdown in the email composer. So if you like to do your formatting in Markdown, which a lot of people do, and Markdown is it's a semantic pseudo markup language, if you will, that lets you use some sort of shorthand, if you will, to send or to create HTML from plain text. And so an example of this would be like if you set like a hash symbol or an octothorpe and then a string of text, that would be like an H1 in HTML. And then if you have like two octothorpes, that would be an H2. So you can kind of like very quickly see some benefit here. I use it a lot for things like documentation, for example, because it's very easy for me in a terminal window or in a plain text editor to quickly crank through documentation without having to fuss with the formatting directly, like by digging through menus or control B's and control I's and digging around for options. I can just kind of write as I'm going and kind of add the markup in line in a way that still preserves readability and legibility for what I'm writing. Whereas if I was writing like actual HTML, it wouldn't necessarily have the same readability, at least, you know, for me,
right?
And probably most people. But it's also easier for me just to kind of work with than it is like a rich text editor or WYSIWYG, if you pardon the expression, TextMate mode. But I came from a background of using text-only console terminal email clients most of my life. I mean, I used Pine and Alpine and the new incarnation of Alpine called ReAlpine. Pine originally was an acronym that stood for Pine is not Elm. Elm was one of the original text-based email clients. And it wasn't, I mean, I was never really an Elm guy. Like, I know people that use it. And in fact, I think that there's someone that I correspond with on a regular basis that actually uses it. Mainly just probably to prove a point, but but I have things like that too, so I can respect that. But
Realpine was kind of a remix of Alpine after the University of Washington, I guess, kind of started distancing and dropping support for Pine and UW IMAP. So I remember that like these open mail standards like IMAP came out of the open source community and have their roots very closely tied to these console and Unix email clients. So it goes way back. I like Mutt mainly because it has a lot of the speed and efficiency of other text-based email clients combined with just massive customization capability. So it's very easy to reassign keystrokes and key bindings. Adding new mail accounts and mailboxes is easy. You can have remote IMAP stores, local maildir folders, inbox files, and you know, like you're pretty much there's really no limit to how you can interact with mail using a program like Mutt. MailMate is IMAP only.
Wow, that's interesting.
It does not support local mail folders, which I'm kind of down about, but through something like, you know, if you really want to have like a local store or something like that, you could always have an IMAP repository running locally, which is a little bit of overhead there. But I think if you're going to do, you know, between POP and IMAP, IMAP is the superior choice. I haven't used POP on purpose for, I don't know, 15 years. I know there's people that still use it, but there's, I mean, the reason I like IMAP is because it has, it lets you have like a remote folder store. So if you have more than one device, you can all have the same view into your email. And that's also, I think, probably the design decision from Benny for MailMate is that the model of having just one mail directory or one mail spool doesn't really fit with most users. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, if you're like me, there's an iPad, there's an iPhone, there's my MacBook, there's my desktop Mac, and I have a central. Well, actually, I should say that because I have several places that I routinely pull for mail, but I do it for all these devices, and they're always giving me the same view of email, and that's what I like about IMAP.
Yeah,
but I also use Mail.app, which is the standard Apple client, and I also spend a lot of time in Outlook for Windows and for OS X. There's some pretty cool stuff. Email's not really going anywhere. It's there's some dude that like I guess issued an edict last week or something about how his company where he works, he was no longer going to be doing email because instant messages and voice over IP and video chat were preferable. And you know, I think if you're an executive with an assistant, that's a very easy thing for you to get away with doing.
Right.
But I think for most people, email is going to be around for a while. So it's definitely something I've spent a lot of time, too much, I should say, time on. I mean, I recently moved like a couple years ago, the Google apps for your domain, my main email account that most things kind of go into ended up getting converted into a Google apps domain.
So, and this is kind of the other side of things. This is the server side of,
yeah,
this is where your mail is being hosted, basically.
Yeah, so I used to have like my own mail server, and I do still, but I had some concerns about this where I didn't like maintaining it, and I didn't like kind of always having it up in the air, like, you know, what happens if something goes wrong with the machine someday. So there was definitely some pressure there. I was worried, and thought that we'd give the Google thing a try, and now, as I think about it, in retrospect, I mean, there's a lot of things about Google hosting my email that I don't like. mainly that, you know, they'll give it away to people that they mine it for ads. And they, you know, there's just all these like open questions that I don't have the answer to and that I have to rely on them providing honest ones for me to, yeah. And then there's like, you know, the rogue employee problem. There's like that dude that was, and I know this is just like, you know, one simple case, but I think it was like a couple years ago, there was a guy in like Washington or Oregon. He had worked for Google and he was like opening people's mailboxes and like reading the contents of them to each other people and like sharing messages from people's private mail accounts, things like that.
And the, and we talked about sort of like the same thing with Dropbox. It's you,
yeah.
You don't have you don't have assurance that all of your data is encrypted in a way that only you can.
I don't have an audit trail. Like they have the ability to audit who accessed my mail, but I don't.
Right.
So, and I don't like that, but, and then there's other like interesting technologies too. Like there's something called Heliotrope, which is being developed.
There's another console email client called SUP. And what SUP does is it basically has some of the similarities in like some of the things that you might like about Google search, like really fast or Google email or Gmail. What's wrong with me? there's a lot of things about that people like the searching and the labeling. And so you can have like one message belong to multiple labels, for example. And Heliotrope wants to give, you know, other mail systems kind of that same capability by providing an alternative to POP or IMAP. And then they have this little web service that you can funnel your messages into, and then they provide like this application interface that you could write clients that would interact with it. And there is like one console email client that talks to this Heliotrope service. And it's interesting. I mean, you can find it on GitHub. It's open source and the guy's got a repository there. But it kind of spun out from the SUP project. And then there's another email tool that was kind of written in response to SUP called Not Much. And what Not Much does, it's not actually an email client.
Oh,
not
this much is terrible.
Yeah, I know. You can't make this up. So there's something called Not Much, and what Not Much will do is import and scan a mailer folder and then let you do very rich queries against the contents of that. It doesn't let you, you know, like author new messages or things like that, but it lets you do very quick searches of email. But, you know, is that really a big deal when you have things like Spotlight or Windows Desktop Search or Google Desktop? You know what I mean? Like, it's kind of a searching is good, but isn't it kind of just available everywhere?
Right, right.
So, yeah. And I mean, and the other problem, and before I turn this over to you, is my main concern when we were making the move to Google was that we were just getting slaughtered with spam.
Okay.
And when I say that we were being slaughtered with spam, I mean we were rejecting, like, before we even did filtering, but like the things that are clearly spam, like over 40,000 messages a day.
Wow.
That's amazing. Huh. That we're just denying based on the fact that there are either known spam block or like known net blocks of bad spam traffic, or they were like known malicious sites. And that's not including the things that they actually, that we would accept the connection from and then do filtering on. Huh. Because that was even another batch of messages. But we were denying tons of messages a day and getting an awful lot of resources tied up due to that issue. And it became kind of a, I mean, at the time, we didn't have much choice.
Well, so on my end, I do all of my email in Apple Mail.
Apple Mail's great. I like it.
Yeah, it's been really good. It's there have been a few changes in Lion that I've been skeptical of.
Blah blah blah.
Yeah, well, but I mean, looking back on it, and I was thinking about this. I think the first mail client I used would have been Apple Mail for, you know. for whatever operating system that was on. I don't even remember. It was probably an OS X operating system before I was using email. Was Apple Mail only on OS X?
Yeah, because before that it was, you know, the same mail client existed, but it was on NextStep and OpenStep.
Okay.
They never had a... Well, that's not true. They had Claris Emailer.
Oh, wait. Was there a mail client that used to be built into Netscape? Or well,
No. It was Netscape Navigator. Still has one today.
Okay,
do you download SeaMonkey from?
All right, then that is the first email client I used.
That's terrible. Email client I ever used was Berkeley Mail, and it had like three commands. And had three commands that I knew how to use.
Anyway, but for most of my life, I've been using Apple Mail, and it has treated me very well. All of my hosting, actually, I have had in various places. Recently moved it all to Fastmail.
I've heard nothing but good things about Fastmail.
Yeah, they are very good. Fastmail.fm. My only complaint is that their web interface is not great. Their webmail
really?
Interface. If you're logging in on the Fastmail website. Which
I thought it looked okay. I mean, I didn't. Like,
yeah, no, it's fine. It's serviceable. It's just not something I would use regularly, which is fine because I don't.
Yeah. Righto. Do you know where their data centers are? Because I mean,
Oh, I don't actually.
Is there like they're a Norwegian or wait? They were acquired by Opera, but
they are a foreign company. I know because there is a small foreign transaction charge that gets added to my bill.
Oh, well, that's good. In my opinion, I mean, they have better privacy laws in other countries.
Okay, yeah. I don't.
That's why I'm curious.
Yeah, I don't know where their data centers are. Here we go. All our servers are hosted a secure facility at New York Internet.
So that's in the U.S.
There you go. Anyway, they're very good. Their email's super reliable. Very fast, very, very fast compared to where I was previously hosting my email, which was on a Bluehost account, which was...
Wasn't Hotmail?
No.
Yahoo.
But Fastmail's great. It's been working really well for me, and having everything in one place, for all my domains, I can direct their MX records to Fastmail and just let it handle everything, and then it doesn't matter if I switch hosting providers or something changes. Fastmail just takes care of everything. So, and it's I'm on like I think one of the middle range personal pro plan or something. I don't remember, but it's like $30 a year, which seems pretty reasonable.
Bad. Yeah. I also have like family accounts, I think, like for households.
Yeah. Yeah. And business accounts and whatever you may need. So,
and there's, I mean, like the, I know people get like a free iCloud account if they have like an iPod or an iPhone or whatever. But, I mean, speaking from experience, I mean, Apple has not necessarily provided a solid email service ever.
And it keeps changing, right?
Yeah.
If your email domain changes every few years, that's not a good email address to have.
The .Mac thing, you still have a .Mac.
Okay. Yeah. But it's not, I mean, you know, with Fastmail, first of all, I control the domains, you know, so my emails are coming in on domain names that I own, which I like a lot.
And Apple took that away.
Oh, did they really?
Yeah, if you log into the new iCloud webmail, you can no longer send mail from other domains.
Oh, that sucks.
You used to be able to have like a custom domain name and use .Mac or whatever, but or MobileMe. But then for some reason in iCloud, that's no longer an option.
Wow, that's odd. Huh.
That sucks.
Yeah. And then for secondary / junk email, I have a Gmail account. That stuff goes to, and that's the sort of I guess my theory that I was, you know, will present as a best practice is just unsubscribe from everything, you know, never get newsletters via email. But when I do on occasion want to subscribe to a newsletter or sign up for a website, I'm not entirely sure whether they're going to spam me or not or something like that, I put in this Gmail address, and so all that gets directed to Gmail, and which is great because Gmail's, you know, spam filtering is really good, and it makes it easy to Gmail is typically pretty good at processing massive amounts of email, and bulk email and whatnot, and filtering and labeling things well. So if I think, you know, my sort of bulk large quantity email all goes into a Gmail account, just so I don't have to manage it myself. Basically,
there's I like using delimited addresses. So, like, you know, if you have a Gmail account, you can have your username and then the plus sign and then some sort of keyword. So, like, if your Gmail address is hellyashow@gmail.com, you could have, like, hellyashow plus Skype. And then when you create a Skype account, you can tell it that your email address is hellyashow plus Skype@gmail.com. And then that will go to your Gmail account and then let you kind of create a filter very easily. And it also lets you then see who has access to that email address.
Right.
Which is kind of nice because as the mail comes in to that keyword address, it will also I don't know if it still does this, but it used to automatically create the label when it comes in.
Oh, nice.
Which is kind of cool too. But a lot of forms for things that you fill out or like shopping carts when you're buying stuff will reject the plus sign.
Oh,
which infuriates me when that happens. And that's the whole reason that I still have like a junk Gmail account that I throw stuff into like that. Just because of, you know, people that are idiots and can't like bother to do a proper form validation on their website.
Sure.
Damn you.
All right. Well, and then as we wrap up here in the last couple minutes, we want to go over some general best practices. We already went over use IMAP instead of POP. So that's a solid one.
Yeah.
One thing I think you espoused this at some point is triage, right?
Yeah. Like I you know, if I can respond to an email in less than 2 minutes, I try to respond to it in less than 2 minutes. And then if I can't, it'll go into, you know, my task list or whatever, but then I archive it. So I try to keep a clean inbox. Like my inbox right now has, well, I can tell you, it has one message in it and it's new.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I mean, you know, I get things out of there very quickly just so I'm not like staring at like a list of 10,000 emails.
Right. Yeah. Another thing is using macros, typing macros. I don't personally do this, but I know you like it.
Yeah, I use a text expander, and I also use I've used before software called Type It For Me. And then MailMate even has like a built-in function for frequently used snippets and templates, if you will. So you can type in like a hotkey and it'll spam in something. And I use that a lot for a lot of the correspondence that I do, interacting with ticketing systems and things like that. At work, I end up having some kind of boilerplate that I can type in a few short characters and it will then type out a very lengthy email for me. And in some cases, just ask me for like one or two variables and then the whole thing is done. And that's all I have to do. So it's very handy and saves me a lot of time.
Yeah, and like whenever I email you, I get that long form response telling me how great I am and how, you know.
That's true.
Yeah,
that's true.
Yeah. and then another thing, we touched on this, but making your inbox size converge to zero.
Actually,
basically.
To back up just a little bit,
yes,
to be completely honest, I do have a macro called brush off. And if I type in the word brush off to an email, it will actually provide a couple of sentences thanking the person for sending me what they sent me and that I really appreciated it. And then I'll get back to them as soon as I can. So if you get that, it took me all of half a second to write.
Okay, great. That is the default response if you email into the Hell Yeah Show.
Yeah, the Hell Yeah Show email account. That's all you're ever going to get back.
Yeah. And then, okay, so making your inbox size converge to zero, also known as inbox zero.
Yeah, that's, I mean, we could probably talk about that a lot at some point.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of benefits to not staring at 10,000 messages.
Right.
And I also, I don't like the nest. I used to, back in the day, I used to have like, you know, a folder for everybody and then folder for projects. And then I was saving messages to multiple folders. And then, I mean, there's a lot of people that still do that, like save correspondence for people. And then the Google approach where you're using labels instead of folders. There's like this whole thing where you can end up like taxonomizing so much. And you're probably not getting as much benefit out of that as Google is. So I would probably rethink that practice. So now what I do is I just have like an archive folder and then I do yearly archives.
Yep.
So as I'm like reading stuff, if I don't need it, I just delete it. And then if I want to keep it around for some reason, I archive it. And then usually like a couple times a year I go through and then I just make yearly folders and dump them out of that. So it's like I just did this. Did you know that Google will... they require a subpoena to like give people your email for the last 180 days, but not after that.
Hmm. Interesting.
Like, so, and I mean, not that I expect being in trouble with the law or anything like that, but like, I think it's a little dumb.
Wait, they will not give it easily for the last 180 days, but before that they will? Or what?
No. But after 180 days, they are less careful.
Huh.
They treat that as like just a database.
Not as sensitive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which I thought was kind of interesting.
Yeah.
So what I try to do is I try to keep things that are older than 180 days archived somewhere else.
Right. Yeah. And then finally, unsubscribe from everything, as I said earlier. Just, you know, question whether you really need to be getting all of those random emails from that band whose newsletter you signed up with to get a free song.
I just wanted the t-shirt.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and I mean, sometimes I don't even know that like unsubscribing works. Like I get so much crap.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, and you can use labels and things to filter it. My point here is more just, you know, yeah, it doesn't take that much energy to delete the message that just came in, but you know, consider the general overhead, the gunking up of your whatever filtering systems you have. The
I got a good one.
Yeah.
If you use Outlook or any email client, really, disable those stupid hand-waving pop-up transparent blobs that come across your monitor every time you get a new message.
Yeah.
Those things are pure Satan.
Those are terrible.
There is a special place in hell for whoever came up with those.
Yes, these are the things in the bottom right of your window that say like the subject of the message, who it's from, and like the first sentence, right?
Yeah.
It's so stupid.
And it's basically, I mean, that's the kind of thing that like really hurts you. Like there are people that think that this is like a really critical feature, but that disrupts your work.
Right. Yeah.
Like that's someone tapping you on the shoulder every time you get an email. And it's like the same thing where I never do like email on my phone, like the alerts. Like there are people that like, you know, back in the day when it was really cool to have a BlackBerry.
there's that blinking light.
Every time it would like buzz, they're like whipping it out like out of their holster, like they're at a, you know, squaring off with someone at high noon, and they're like checking their messages. And if you're doing that and you're getting messages from a band you saw 5 years ago, that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Like just give up. Like right. That's like, yeah, that would put me over the edge. I would go out the window at that point.
Yeah. No, I quit Apple Mail whenever I am not checking email.
Yeah. Like, and I don't use automatic checks.
It checks automatically when it's open, but it is only open when I want to check email. So
that's not bad.
Yeah. Anyway. All right. Well, that will probably do it for this episode of the Hell Yeah Show. That's our take on email. So.
Sorry, I'm so tired today. I don't feel like I had really great energy.
Well, I mean, you certainly had lots to say. So
that's true.
It's all good in the end.
I can't shake this.
I think everyone is sick right now, no matter what. It is that time of year. All right, if you want to contact us, you can email us at show@hellyeah.com. If you want to visit us online, you can go to show.hellyeah.com. And
that's on IPv4 and IPv6.
Exactly.
And also on the Twitter machine at twitter.com/hellyeahshow or @hellyeahshow.
All right, very good. We are done here for episode 17. We will see you next week.
Back from whence you came.